This is the Walking Home from the ICU podcast. I'm Kaylee Dayton, a nurse practitioner and ICU consultant. I help teams create awake and walking ICUs through evidence-based sedation and mobility practices. By hearing from survivors, clinicians, and researchers, we'll explore how to give ICU patients the best chance to walk out of the ICU and go home to survive and thrive. Welcome to the ICU Revolution. For years, early mobility has been a hot and controversial topic. Even recently, I was told by a physician that their physical therapists will only do passive range of motion for intubated patients and that anything beyond that is too intensive and dangerous. Yes, in 2023, that was said. It feels like early mobility is often glazed over as a, for some few select patients in our wildest dreams, but for now, we're just going to work on daily awakening trials. When that is the mentality and approach, our teams and patients end up missing out on the incredible benefits of the full ABCDEF bundle. The rest of the elements in the bundle stay beyond our reach when we are not aspiring to do the highest level of mobility on most of our patients. Heidi Engel joins us now to clear the air on what early mobility is and how it is supposed to be utilized in the ABCDEF bundle. Heidi, welcome back to the podcast. This is your third episode here on the podcast, but will you introduce yourself again?
Hi, I'm Heidi Engel. I'm a physical therapist at UCSF Medical Center in San Francisco, California. And I have been working in the intensive care unit, mostly medical ICU, but also surgical and cardiac and neuro ICUs at our institution for a good solid 15 years full time. Prior to that, I was creating our ICU mobility collaborative at UCSF, our interprofessional group, because this is never a physical therapy project. This is always an interprofessional team sport, which is part of why I love what I do. And I was a founding member of the ICU Liberation Committee for the Society of Critical Care Medicine. So I've been a pioneer of promoting the A to F bundle.
And I consider you one of the main experts on all things ICU early mobility. And that's why you're here to talk about the E of the ABCDF bundle, which is early mobility and or exercise. It's listed in different ways. Let's just cover what is early mobility.
Early mobility is having a patient in the intensive care unit, no matter what type of equipment they happen to be on, whether it be ET tube mechanical ventilation or ECMO or balloon pumps or you name it, of what we can provide to people in the intensive care unit, CRRT, nitric oxide. So the equipment is not the barrier in the early mobility definition. The objective is to have your patient who walked into the hospital and was admitted into the ICU for some reason to walk out of the hospital. And because there is a profound amount of weakness and cognitive and psychological changes that happen as a result of having to be in an intensive care unit on all that life-saving equipment and with the life-saving medications, it is really easy for people to lose their abilities to get up and walk around, to engage in their job and perform their work activities. So early mobility is at the soonest opportunity you can. You want your patient to be awake and able to participate in their own care through an ability to communicate and an ability to get up and walk around, because walking is a normal survival skill. It's for most people not an exercise per se.
And talk to us about highest level of mobility. Why is that important and how do you determine that?
Highest level of mobility is important because, you know, there's a wealth of physiologic research, not necessarily in the world of critical care, but certainly in the world of cancer care. So if you want to say, okay, yes, exercise physiology principles need to be applied to people to prevent cardiovascular disease or to help them recover from chronic lung disease, But those people aren't very sick. You can then switch gears and look at the oncology world. So in the oncology world, there's been a wealth of exercise research demonstrating people who are very sick and actively going through chemotherapy have the same responses that healthy people have to activity that induces an aerobic response of some sort to what you are doing. So some elevated heart rate, some elevated respiratory rate within the setting of activity. Best case scenario is activity involves weight bearing on the legs, because we all know intuitively that it is the large skeletal muscle in your legs that facilitate better functioning of your heart and lungs, right? I always tell my family members and the patients, you know, when you want your heart and lungs to work better and to be stronger, you don't sit on the edge of a bed with a clothespin on your nose and take nice breaths. You stand up and run up a hill, because it's the messaging and the signaling of those large skeletal muscles and the weight bearing on your legs that actually facilitates a lot of physiologic normality and a beneficial exercise response. And we haven't done this well in the critically ill patient population per se, but we've done it incredibly well in people in cancer research. So hospitalized patients, patients undergoing stem cell transplants, people having chemotherapy, exercise seems to be the very beneficial medication for anyone at any phase of their lifetime, even when they're very sick.
And I think highest level mobility is really important to be bringing into this conversation, because early mobility has had such a ambiguous connotation or definition throughout the history of early mobility. So let's talk about a little bit of maybe the history of how early mobility came to be and why we are where we are as far as having so many different interpretations and applications of early mobility.
Okay. Well, the history of it for me started with, I previously was a floor PT working with liver transplant patients and hematological oncology patients. And those patients would end up in the ICU at some point. And I would follow them into the ICU and go into this foreign, scary place and look around and go to the nurse and say, I have an order to see this patient for physical therapy. And the nurse would say, I don't know why. They're on a ventilator. And I'd say, yeah, I don't know why either. And I would walk out. And that was probably 2007. And finally, at one point, and I have to say that the thing that has helped me be on this path for as long as it has, as I have, is how much the patients and the families love mobility. They love mobility more than we do. They have been the driving force for me. They have been the guiding light that has shown to me that I really need to keep doing this and that it's so important. And so I had a patient end up in the ICU. I had no ICU experience because I'd always been told passive range of motion is what you do in the ICU setting. And I was like, well, do I need to do passive range of motion as a physical therapist? Can a nurse do passive range of motion? I have other patients to go see out on the floor. And that was my ICU experience. So finally, I had a patient who was on a ventilator, really wanted to get up out of bed. He was a nurse. His family were a bunch of nurses. They were from a different country. Maybe that made the difference. I have no idea why they were so adamant that he needed to be up out of bed, even though he was on the ventilator. And the nurse said, this is crazy. He can't do that. He's on a ventilator. And I kept looking at him and he was awake. And I said, do you want to get up out of bed? And he would vigorously nod his head and he looked strong enough and his family was eager to help me. And so we just did it. And after we just did that, I thought, well, wait, is this what we should be doing for everyone? Like, why? Because he looked
why
great.
Why did he do that? And the 99.9% of the rest of our patients can't do that.
Yeah. So I started to do some research and there was nothing practically. There was a study by Pete Morris and it was a lot of bed level activity. But then there was Polly Bailey's 2007 article in Critical Care Medicine describing how these very sick patients on ventilators are getting up and walking down the hall, you know, PF rushes of 100, Apache scores of 26. And she's got pictures in this article of these people just walking down the hall on a ventilator. And I had a student at the time, and I looked at the article and I said, I didn't even know this was possible. How is this even possible? I thought there's no way you can walk on a ventilator. Why? Wait. And I just like sent sparks off in my head to say, wait, why aren't we doing this? If this is possible, why aren't we doing this for every patient? Everyone needs to, like, walking is, to me, walking and breathing and eating and drinking, these are foundational things humans do. So that was the start of the journey. I was connected to Dale Needham, who is now the world's leader and expert on ICU, all things ICU early mobility and rehab. They were just starting their program at Johns Hopkins. He was incredibly generous with sharing a lot of information with me about the program they were starting. I went to see what Polly Bailey did. She was extraordinarily generous. And then she said, this is the hardest thing you'll ever do in your life. And I was a little scared because I felt like she knew a lot.
And she'd been fighting this, or, you know, moving the needle on this for, at that point, probably 15 years.
Yeah. So, okay. Around that brings us, you know, that was around 2010. In 2013, the Society of Critical Care Medicine published the updated PAD guidelines with Julie Barr, who you had a great interview with on your podcast. She was the lead author of the Pain, Agitation, Delirium guidelines. And what happened between, it took them 5 years, right? A clinical practice guideline is taking all the evidence and making recommendations to clinicians based on what all the evidence everywhere says. It's a huge undertaking. So between when they started the development of the PAD guidelines in 2008 and the publication of it in 2013, 5 years it took, mobility had become a bit of a thing. Hopkins was starting, we were starting, Pete Morris's article was out there more, Schweikert's study was published in Lancet 2009. The Australians had been making a lot of, you know, presentations on how they mobilized their patients in the ICU there. So there was a lot coming together. But because it wasn't on anyone's radar in 2008 when they created the group for the PAD guidelines, there was no mention of mobility. So this is a 52-page guideline. There is two sentences, I think, that describe mobility. And it essentially says for the delirium part, we recommend, you know, early mobility as a potential treatment for delirium. That's it. That's all the whole thing that the PAD guidelines in 2013 could say about mobility. But thanks to the wonderful committee that group was, Brenda Pund, Julie Barr, Wes Ely, they appreciated that. Oops, we missed mobility in this. How do we want to address that now that we're going to be trying to have people adopt these guidelines? So Society of Critical Care Medicine created this ICU Liberation Committee and decided to use the A to F bundle as the toolkit to help the PAD guidelines, meaning the evidence that's out there, be put into practice. It's just a toolkit. And they wanted mobility to be a part of that. That is the E of the bundle, even though the PAD guidelines didn't specifically mention it. So I had been floating around enough with the Institute for Healthcare Improvement and a bit with the Society of Critical Care Medicine that they asked me to be part of that committee to help make mobility something that everyone thought about in regards to the PAD guidelines.
And then we had the big study published in 2019 showing incredible outcomes. But yes. What did we see about actual implementation of the E?
What I found with the IC Liberation Initiative, and that's what you're describing. So we went from a committee of let's turn the 2013 PAD guidelines into practice. How can we do that? We had a grant funding. We had Society of Critical Care Medicine backing. We created this collaborative of 60 different ICUs who applied to the Society of Critical Care Medicine to be part of this program, to receive a lot of training and mentoring and education. And we asked them to do data collection, to have a project manager, an interdisciplinary team, and to do randomized data collection to see how well they implemented the bundle through this whole year and a half project. And what we found is folks really tended to apply the bundle as if you were going point by point through the alphabet. So lots of great compliance with the A, the B was better than ever, the C has gotten better, the D sort of, the E, you know, honestly, not so much. I was personally a little stunned when the raw data came back and we looked at how early mobility had been defined. So because it was so firmly based in bed level activity. So there wasn't passive range of motion, and the definition seemed to be a lot of bed level activity.
So only 12% were actually out of bed bearing weight. Only 5% of those were actually taking steps in the hall.
And that was any time during their ICU stay. And that included both ventilated and non-ventilated patients.
Okay.
So that's what I consider quite low level activity for if you're looking at your entire ICU population, because we all have non-vented patients in the ICU, right?
Right. Yeah. They should be easy. Right. Anyone can develop delirium. Anyone can develop ICU-acquired weakness. It's not just about the ventilators. But we know that being sedated expedites the development of ICU-acquired weakness. And it's much harder to walk down the hall after being sedated and immobilized once you're extubated. If you get extubated, right, it decreases their chances of being successfully extubated. So obviously, we made really good strides in the right direction. But I love how you bring up how this was the first elements of the bundle, because we were very fixated in going sequentially in alphabetical order. We still missed a lot of opportunities to optimize outcomes, but we found in that study that outcomes were dose dependent. The Yes. closer they got to being awake and walking, the better their outcomes were. And that's not just because of acuity. People will bring that up all the time. Well, of course, if patients are well enough to be awake and walking, they're going to do, their acuity is not as high, they're going to do better, which is not necessarily what we're talking about. We're talking about patients that are walking during critical illness. And despite their acuity, they do better because of the interventions, right? So now here we are in 2023, and there's still a lot of turmoil when it comes to early mobility. We still have passive range of motion being accepted as part of early mobility. We have lots of fear regarding early mobility. We know from Peter Nidal's meta-analysis that with over 14,000 activity sessions, the adverse event rate was 0.6%. But now we have newer studies coming out. Well, no, a new study coming out. Not to make it plural, it was just the one. Let's just talk about the team. Let's just put it out there. Let's talk about the team study, because I'm finding every team that I've worked with since that study came out, almost every discussion I have with anybody that wants to validate what they're doing as far as low level of mobility or no mobility brings up the team study as their validation that it is too risky and what they're doing is the optimal care. What do we know from the team study as far as, is this really so dangerous?
What do we know from the team study? Well, first, I think I need to clarify that if you asked me for what I believe is the correct definition of early mobility, I fully believe in what you have said in your more than 150 episodes of your podcast at this point, which is awake and walking is the standard that we should aim for. Can every single patient every time be awake and walking, no matter what the equipment, No, but can a vast majority of the patients in your ICU? I would say yes. I would challenge everyone everywhere to make that the definition of early mobility. But the awake part has to be part of the picture. And when I talk about the awake part, and this will get us to the team trial, when I talk about the awake part, as someone who has probably mobilized everyone on every kind of medication known to man and seen the impact of that, I have to say that we have to stop believing that RAS zero or RAS minus one to zero and awake are the same thing, because they're not. I can have people in bed, eyes open, nodding their head, CAM ICU negative, but propofol was turned off an hour ago. For example, a propofol drip was on all night long, as was some fentanyl. The propofol has come off to allow the patient to be awake. It's been an hour, so everyone's quite sure it's left their system, which it has not, right? It sits in their adipose tissue. It's a lipophilic drug. And depending on how much they've received over how much time, it's continuing to feed into their bloodstream. So their brain has adapted to it. Our brains really want to be awake and walking. Our brains want this. Your brain craves to not be sedated, lying in bed, no matter how sick you are. So the propofol is off. Everyone sees their eyes open. Their CAM ICU negative. Great. We're calling that awake. However, what I watch when we start moving that awake person is coordinating the movement of walking, having the cardiopulmonary tolerance and aerobic capacity for good walking without becoming tachycardic or having AFib, especially when they've had baseline AFib, or having a hypertensive episode or a hypotensive episode of some sort. It's really hard to achieve that level of mobility with that drug scenario. So I feel very strongly, and this is after years and years and years of mobilizing people, that it's not accurate to call someone awake who has been pretty deeply sedated for days or even hours and hours overnight. And then today you turn the drug off, making them capable of very basic low-level interaction and eyes open all the time. You're calling that awake and you want to walk them down the hall. It's really hard to do that. You can do it sometimes, but it's messy and it's ugly and it doesn't work very well. And the patients who have been allowed to have the sedation turned off and stay off and actually let them metabolize it, so which to me can take days depending on how long it's been. So even though the propofol is a short acting drug, it really does stay in their system and impact their brain, their functional capability, their coordination, their balance, and very much so their cardiopulmonary response, right? We know these drugs work on everyone's baroreceptors. So why are we thinking it's unusual if we're trying to help these patients stand up and get out of bed, we turn the propofol off, but they still hemodynamically look like they're exerting super hard. You know, it's the drug. It's the drug. It hasn't really left the patient. Plus, you might
really destabilize them. And that's, you know, an awake and walking ICU that I worked in. We mobilize patients oftentimes, you know, hours after intubation, at least within the first 24 hours, usually within 12 hours. I mean, it was really prompt that we were mobilizing them. And they rarely ever had propofol running right after intubation. There had to be extremely good reason, like seizures, intracranial hypertension. There had to be an indication for that sedation. And so patients remained so intact cognitively, physically. I mean, propofol is a mitochondrial toxin. It is toxic to the muscles. So you can't just give it for 4 to 6 days and then expect those muscles to be able to fire and function, even if you haven't lost large volume of mass, which is improbable. If you've had it running for that long, you're going to lose mass, right? But you also lose function. So we destabilize our patients with sedation.
Yes. So getting back to the team trial, number one, I want to say this is an incredible study, right? This is an incredible feat that Carol Hodson and the ANZICS group have pulled off. They did something we were absolutely craving in the world of critical care and ICU early mobility in particular. They had a huge, large study, you know, an N of over 700 patients, 50 different ICUs around the world, and a very distinct protocol to follow that really encouraged people to help patients get up and move out of bed as soon as possible. And again, this study was 10 years in the making, right? So between 2012, and let's face it, that's now getting you back before the PAD guidelines were even published, right? So none of us are really knowing much about mobility or even doing it very much at the points where we're putting this study together and designing it. We might be asking different questions today than we were ready to ask 5 and 10 years ago. So this study is a brilliant undertaking. It has a lot of data in it, more data than any other mobility study ever. It's published in the medical journal of the highest impact of all the medical journals, New England Journal of Medicine. And so it's not a study we can discount or I would ever recommend discounting. But I think when you drill down into all that data, particularly the supplemental part of the article, which isn't the main published part. You really have to go someplace else and go through all the supplemental tables. When you drill down through all of that data, I personally have a different narrative I draw from that data than I think the authors did. And so to me, their narrative has been a little controversial. Because their narrative is, look, we had an intervention group that got more intensive mobility, and we had a control group which got what we're calling a good level of mobility. And this is the only difference between the two groups, and therefore anything we saw that didn't create a positive outcome or anything we saw that was an adverse event, it can only be due to the mobility because everything else was controlled for. So, you know the ICU, you know this, and there's nothing in this study that talks about sedation at all. It's a big black box in this study. We don't know what drugs people received. We don't know how long they received it. We don't know in what pattern they received it. We can guess, those of us like you, Kaylee, who, you know, work in a lot of different ICUs or talk to a lot of different people who do work in ICUs, can see that it's very standard practice for a drug to go off. Propofol goes off a bit during the day, goes back on at night. That we have learned to call sedation sleep and rest, and that sleep and rest is really not the same at all, right?
If you've been listening to this podcast, you're likely convinced that sedation and mobility practices in the ICU need to change. The ICU community is facing incredible difficulty with the trauma from the pandemic, staffing crisis, and burnout. We cannot afford to continue practices that result in poor patient outcomes, more time in the ICU, higher healthcare costs, and greater workload for the ICU team. Yet the prospect of changing decades of beliefs, practices, and culture across all disciplines of the ICU is a daunting task. How does this transformation start? It can begin with a consultation with me to discuss your team's current practices, barriers, and to formulate a plan to help your ICU become an awake and walking ICU. I help teams master the ABCDEF bundle through education, consulting, simulation training, and bedside support. Let's work together to move your team into the future of evidence-based ICU care. Click the link in the show notes of this episode to find out more.
to me, the narrative of the team trial is, nobody really achieved a whole lot of out of bed walking down the hall, particularly early in their stay. Within the first week, honestly, the majority of people were doing bed and bed level activity. And to me, that's a low level because I want folks awake and walking before they lose their ability to walk. The other thing about the team trial is there's a lot made about the adverse event rate was higher in the intensive mobility group. And again, because their narrative is, well, we controlled for everything else, and the only difference between these two groups is the level of mobility. So it must be the mobility is the problem. I'm not sure that the mobility is the problem. It makes sense if you look again at the all the factors that play into what mobility is in the ICU. So to me, the narrative of this study is we're continuing to attempt to do everything while we also sedate our patients, and maybe that's not working out as optimally as it should. That what we need is a team trial 2.0 where the intervention is your patient's going to be awake and walking, which means once the drug is off, it stays off, because sleep and sedation are not the same thing. And because a patient needs rest in the form of sleep in order to be able to have the wherewithal to get up and walk down the hall the next day. And sedation makes all of that too challenging for everyone.
Or impossible. I mean, sedation
or impossible
prevents sleep. It disrupts the brain. There's not real sleep. They don't go through the full REM cycles under sedation. And we saw in the team's trial that they were at a RASA negative 3 for 4 to 6 days before starting mobility. And when I see that RASA negative 3, I'm not sure if I really believe that. Granted, this was in Australia. Maybe they have impeccable RAS scores, but we see in Brazil and here in the States that 50 to 70% of our RAS scores are inaccurate, that they are likely more deeply sedated than we're actually charting. So when I see negative 3, I really wonder, I don't know, that negative 3 easily becomes a negative 4, a negative 5, and that exacerbates the harm happening to our patients while they're sedated. So nonetheless, without looking through the supplemental tables and understanding the methodology and asking these questions, many of us, it's easy to just go through the abstract, find the last two sentences of the conclusion, and say, aha, see, early mobility is dangerous and it does nothing. And that's what I'm hearing from people, which is obviously really concerning, and it's creating a whole new barrier to really practicing the ABCDF bundle. I see the initial steps of the bundle as tools to enable the E part and the F part of the bundle and the C and the D, right? But if we don't have them awake, we can't mobilize them, but we should be waking them up to mobilize them, and not as a holiday break interruption, but to have them awake and able to mobilize throughout their time in the ICU. What are your thoughts?
Not just mobilize, Kaylee, but communicate. Mm-hmm. So, I can tell you a quick story of a patient that I had recently who walked into an outpatient sports medicine procedure as a 30-year-old with a torn Achilles tendon needing surgery. He went into the outpatient sports medicine Achilles tendon repair, had a massive anaphylactic reaction to one of the drugs he had to receive, needed intubation for airway protection, and then woke up the next day in our ICU. So imagine how confused and distraught he was to come out of his Achilles tendon outpatient procedure and find a tube down his throat in an intensive care unit when he had no previous medical history. So none of this is anything anywhere near familiar to him in the world. And so what is his reaction to being woken up a little bit? He is panicked. When he panics, his heart rate gets very fast. His respiratory rate gets very fast. He's having trouble synchronizing his breathing with the ventilator, even though it's a pressure support ventilation setting. His wife is there and she sees monitors and machines beeping and going crazy and him looking very distraught. And she obviously thinks something's wrong. And the nurse says, I know how to fix this, and turns propofol on to help him rest.
Technically, all of that meets a failed awakening trial criteria.
Yes, exactly. In a 30-year-old with the airway protection, receiving steroids to bring down the anaphylactic swelling of his airway, right? Nothing crazy going on here.
Right, but if he's sedated and receiving steroids and immobilized.
Oh, yes.
A 30-year-old is going to turn into the physical capacity of an 89-year-old very fast.
Yes. And something weird happens in hospital settings where everyone is happy when anyone of any age or background who can get up independently and toddle down a hall with a front wheel walker is called independent, and we're all good with that. But I'll leave that aside. So I asked the nurse on this particular patient, what's the propofol for? And she said, this is what happens when we turn it off. He gets agitated and crazy. So he, you know, I can give him a dosage of propofol that helps him keep his eyes awake. So he's technically a RASS minus 1-0, but on a propofol drip. And young people do that, right? They've got good, healthy organs. They metabolize the drugs. Their drive to be awake is huge. You can have people awake on propofol drips. And I'm amazed at how much staff are very happy about that. Like, this is great. You know, and I've had this saying for a very long time. Okay, but you don't understand. This drug is not your little glass of Chardonnay at the end of the day. Like, this is not...
It's still toxic.
Yeah, it's not this little relaxation tool. So the family member is confused. She says, yeah, like, let him rest. He needs rest. And so we spoke to her and said, you know, but there are a lot of potential side effects to other organ systems in his body. If we let him rest on this drug propofol, even though his eyes are open. And she said, like, what organ systems? And this was someone who was in a very intellectual career. And I said, well, his brain. And he was stunned. And I'm like, what do you mean his brain? And I said, yeah, it causes, you know, long-term cognitive impairment. It increases psychological trauma over time. It's not really the kind of thing you want to rest on. And she said, well, then turn it off, which we did, because I guarantee to the nurse, it's a, you know, we'll do this. I'll get the respiratory therapist. We'll get him up moving. She's like, well, it's okay. He can write on a clipboard. Now we have a 30-year-old with a very high intellectual capacity scribbling the most basic illegible sentence on a clipboard because he is a RAS zero, but this is what his brain function capability is.
It's propofol handwriting.
It's propofol handwriting. Function. And again, we are so adapted to this drug being a good thing, a compassionate thing, a rest thing, a calming down thing, that we're willing to accept that. She's like, see, he can write on the clipboard. And I was like, I don't, like, that doesn't seem like his writing. I don't know.
Not his baseline. So
we turned off the drug. We got him up. We walked down the hall and we sat him back in the chair. And now he's able to text on his phone and communicate by typing with his fingers. And he can write now full paragraphs on the clipboard that are legible. So there's a certain amount of what are we willing to accept and what is our understanding of what propofol does and doesn't do when we're also discussing what is a level of mobility that our patients should engage in, and what is intensive mobility versus what is, you know, good, we can accept this level of mobility. And I think we just haven't developed the standard of awake and walking sufficiently in the ICU, to really see all the profound benefits it can have. And that's why, as you know, I have said, I feel like we got the bundle a little bit wrong and it should be the F to A bundle, because in order to have, you know, that wife was incredibly happy and able to communicate with her husband, and they were able to discuss what really happened to him. And she was thrilled to see him walk. She was thrilled to stand and look out the window at the view with him. She was thrilled to understand that seeing all this to her meant he wasn't going to stay in the ICU. He was going to just go home a walking person. So, but in order to make that happen, we had to do all the other elements, right? And we had to do all the other elements to the highest extent. We couldn't accept that, well, yeah, the propofol is on or the Prestex is on, but their eyes are open and they can kind of scribble something on a clipboard. Therefore, they're good to go. Like, let's just keep them chill on this drug while you also do everything else.
And it's easy when it's hanging there to sneak back up overnight and later on. I mean, it's just, it's really hard to have that be an option just there. And that's a great example of how those initial elements of the bundle empowered the E and the F. And the E and the F made the initial elements of the bundle easier and more feasible. I see this happening in teams where they say, we're just going to focus on SATs, SBTs. Our charting is improving. We're having more compliance. And we'll start with that and we'll do mobility later. I see such a challenge to that because mobility enables patients to be awake, free of delirium, calm, treats their anxiety, keeps their brain intact. All of those things keep patients safer, makes it easier for the staff. I think that makes it less likely that they end up being sedated to control the agitation. So when you only focus on the initial bundle, you'll really never probably get to the E, but you also can't fully master the initial elements of the bundle without the E and the F. So I love the F to A approach. It makes sense to me. If we're really focusing on families being communicative, engaged, interacting with the patients, that will guide our sedation practices. And then you can finally get to the E. What are the main barriers to real, true early mobility throughout the ICU community right now?
I think a misunderstanding of how vital being upright and mobile is to the physiologic normalization of patients. Lungs and diaphragm start to adapt to their new positive pressure, lying without the force of gravity, horizontal positioning situation within 24 hours. Doesn't take days, takes even less than 24 hours, but let's just call it a day. Within a day of being intubated, your body is now adapting as if we have sent you in a spaceship into outer space and started reversing the way you normally breathe. And so your body does this maladaption, really, and things start functioning abnormally. So in order to actually ideally help lungs, you position someone fully upright and not smashing the back surface area of their lungs by lying supine or even having a bed placed in a chair position. I think we're afraid of mobility. I think I've watched fear of mobility be something that prohibits mobility over and over and over again. And it's almost one of the biggest areas to have to tackle is the fear. Now, the problem with the fear is we treat our fear with sedation and we treat, you know, sedation gives us a ton of control and predictability over our patients, right? So a sedated patient looks calm, numbers look great. We don't worry about them pulling anything out. We don't worry about them doing anything unsafe. We don't really worry about them hemodynamically so much. Sedation really gives us the providers a sensation of our own comfort and that we have rested and the machines are going to help this patient. And then as the medicines and machines help the patient, we'll slowly take this away. But for today, numbers look great. patient's looking sweet in bed. They look eyes closed, like they're just having a nice nap.
And it's familiar. It's, again, controlled. It's predictable.
Yes. So if I come along and I'm like, no, turn that drug off and let's get this person out of bed, you know, it's like, wow, that is a big, messy, potentially risky, dangerous thing. Why? And the problem is, I have seen over and over and over again, is it actually is harder, and it probably doesn't work well, as is reflected in the team trial, when we're doing it this halfway approach, when we're trying to both sedate our patients and mobilize our patients, because I'm asked to do this all the time. And it's really hard. It's a much more challenging job for me.
And it's not as productive or fruitful.
For the patient, getting them to be able to focus, coordinate, understand. It is my patients I have, and we do this routinely with our lung transplant patient population. People are waiting for lungs. That particular team at my institution shuts the sedation off immediately and never allows it to go back on, and insists that those patients get up and walk down the hall. Are the first couple of days difficult? Yes. I think day one is never going to be not difficult for the most part.
They're acclimating.
But the investment on day one gets you so much. It's the return on your investment of doing this hard thing this one time and making sure the sedation is fully off and that this patient is writing. A writing test is the perfect thing to me. Maybe the next bundle could be. And the way you know if you've complied with this bundle is your patient can write a complete sentence on a clipboard. And it makes sense, and the handwriting is legible. Then you,
Dr. Lance Paddock says that the C perhaps should be communication. I'm trying to get teams to make this part of their rounding is, how is the patient communicating? To reinforce it, that should be our expectation, and that everyone be wanting patients to communicate, knowing how they communicate, making that a huge focus, because that, again, will inspire and guide our sedation practices.
Or C for patient control. Believe it or not, when we allow our patients to guide their own care, they do so much better. They don't get agitated. They're cooperative. They're helpful. They're appreciative. They're, you know, so much comes together so well. People, I believe, resist this way we treat them, which is to just completely disempower them, right? We're tying their hands to bed rails. We don't allow them to talk. They think they should be able to eat and drink. And obviously that's not something we can possibly give them, but they will understand foregoing that when they can understand it in the context of their illness. So I see us having a future world where the ICU Liberation 2.0 is the F to A bundle, and early mobility is described as awake and walking down the hall, and that the lessons of the team trial are perhaps mobility isn't as easily achieved or well achieved in terms of walking quickly before you lose your ability to walk. So within a day or two of intubation, when we're also still providing a lot of sedation through the remainder of the day. I mean, a lot of the ideas I have about how to mobilize or exercise patients in the ICU setting comes, one, from, I said, oncology research I read, but also exercise physiology research that I read. And I'm ready for the study that takes healthy participants, puts them in a propofol drip at night, gets them up during the day, has them exercise, and the control group is the group that didn't have any propofol on at night, healthy people. And let's see the impact of what exactly that propofol is doing in your ability to coordinate your motion, tolerate activity the next day. Because I will bet money that we still have a lot to learn about how these drugs are really negatively impacting the functional capability, as you said, a mitochondrial toxin. Now your muscles have been starved, literally starved all night long. And tomorrow you're going to get up and walk around on them.
And we've seen the team study and in other mobility studies that the main barriers are sedation and agitation.
The WEAN study, the WEAN trial that was just published in Lancet. So the one that has the force plot with the, it shows clearly that the greatest barrier is sedation. And I think it is because we have misdefined what sedation is capable of versus what harm it does. I think we have routinely seen it as a nice way to help you relax and get through the trauma of your ICU stay. And it doesn't turn out to be true, but we don't have a robust enough counter messaging or demonstration of awake and walking ICUs everywhere to tell people that this drug has more harm than benefits. And it's not just propofol, right? We're also talking, people say, well, we'll just leave them on Prasadex drips all the time because their eyes are open on Prasadex. I've had so many patients' knees buckle on the Prasadex drip partway down the hall versus when there's no Prasadex. Obviously, fentanyl drips have also their own. So I think we have to start learning to trust the human body better and the will to live. You know, Wes has his thing about people need to know their why to live. And they have to be awake, right? Wes Ely said that on one of your previous episodes. They have to know their why to live, and they have to be given an opportunity to strive for their why to live. And again, I come from the oncology world. I see the power of that is profound. Do I have a large multi-center trial to demonstrate it? No. I have so much experience and I have so much faith in the people who become our patients. Once you connect with them as people, and I've heard this from your other participants as well, so I feel like I'm preaching to the choir or else I'm just repeating similar messaging, but it is ever so true. On the other side of your machines and your drips, there are people with amazing lives and incredible stories, and you're depriving them of those lives and those stories when you have them lying in bed as an inert body that needs to have certain numbers and values hit in their day. And I would add one more. You have an episode where you interview the nurse who started the ECMO program in Texas, I think.
They improved mortality by 30%.
Yes. And just listen, you know, her story also is really fantastic. In that she also describes multiple times in her interview with you how much that when the nursing staff saw the patients become people and got to know them as people, that there was a healing connection, right? There was a bond and a healing connection that really you can't quantify that. And it is genuine.
That's episode 118.
Yeah, you can't provide that to a half awake person. Eyes, just opening your eyes should not be a standard of how we perceive like we've done the right thing by a patient.
And I'm seeing with teams that we've worked with that's a key part of sustaining these programs, ICU liberation. I mean, when we only see it as awakening breathing trials, we'll never get there. We'll never have that human connection. There's such a humanization of walking, of being upright, sitting inside of the bed, bearing your own weight, riding a clipboard. That is the vision that our clinicians need to have when we're talking about the ABCDF bundle. If it's just SATs, SPTs, we will never really get to know our patients and never enjoy watching them walk out the doors. And not every patient can walk even at baseline, but we're preserving their baseline function. And by doing that, we're preserving their humanity. And when we talk about the risks of early mobility, we need to really look at what we're talking about and hold it up against the risks of not practicing early mobility. That's, I think, what we're really lacking in our discussions. We're seeing with TIMSS trial, 7 times greater risk. But again, were those, how many of those patients, how many of those events were from the same patients? How much of that was observational bias? How much that was from the destabilization from sedation and mobility for 4 to 6 days? In the Polly Bailey study, their median PF ratio was 89. These were sick patients and their adverse event rate was 0.6%. And yeah, it's because they were promptly walking.
Yeah, there is, I'm going to make sure I don't screw up the lead author's name here. There is a meta-analysis in 2020 by Petra Waldauf, W-A-L-D-A-U-F.
I'll put it in the transcript.
It's a meta-analysis of early mobility studies. And they had a no adverse event rate in that meta-analysis. It also showed that the in-bed, the bed bikes and the neuro-e-stim in bed that people want to do did not have the better outcomes that just physically getting up and moving out of bed in a functional way did. So there's definitely more than one study out there on early mobility. It has been shown to be honestly an incredibly safe intervention. I will put my early mobility intervention up against almost anything else we do in the ICU. Let's look at CLABSI rates, right? Well, what's the risk of putting in a central line? There's a risk of infection introduction. We know this for real. It's tracked, right? There's a risk.
One study showed a 300% increase in early mobility decreased all hospital acquired infections by 60%.
Right. We have Laura Ferrante's study about how it would decrease ventilator associated pneumonias by mobilizing patient up out of bed. We have
by 40%
study about long-term cognitive improvement in the group that mobilized within 24 hours to 48 hours after intubation, right? So there are the benefits far outweigh the risk. There's nothing we ever do in the ICU that has really zero risk, genuinely. But my concern is we still think sedation needs to be part of the whole package, and the sedation makes mobility so much riskier than my people who are awake. My people who are awake, where the sedation is off and it's really staying off, you know, day one is a little hard. Day two is a little hard. Day three, I walk in the morning, I go to their room, I'm waving, they're waving back, they're smiling, they're writing on the clipboard, when are we walking? You know, they know the routine. They get up, how's it going at home? How's the dog doing? You know, we have this exchange and interaction. It's all very normal and routine. And there's 4 pillars of all human health, right? It is exercise, nutrition, sleep. But the number 4 pillar, and this is in every kind of wellness research ever done anywhere, the 4th one is social engagement and interaction. We humans need that. And that is healing. And you cannot do that if you're sedated and hallucinating at night and I'm shutting it off for a couple hours during the day.
I was surprised to hear from survivors that part of their trauma is the isolation.
Yeah.
And it made me think, when else do we ever not talk to other humans and have human touch and real human connection other than solitary confinement, which drives people to insanity?
Right.
So are we putting patients into solitary confinement when we sedate them? And all of it just plays into this whole picture of dehumanization.
Yeah.
And that is what we're liberating patients from, not just the ventilator. I just came from a meeting and it sounded like this ICU liberation was just for SATs, SVTs to get them off the ventilator. That was it. That's extended the discussion. We're liberating them from critical illness, from the ventilator, from sedation, from the bed. We're liberating them from a future of disability and yes, isolation and ramifications of sedation and immobility. We're freeing them from all of that. And when that's our focus, then the E finally becomes a key priority as a life-saving intervention, not just an afterthought if you get to it. It's part of saving lives as a whole.
Yeah. And people want to stay breathing. So once they understand that they need that ET tube, you know, the patients who are kept awake, we're getting them up to walk down the hall and they're like holding the ET tube for us, you know, while we're rearranging other equipment, or they're telling us exactly where to move it so it's more comfortable for them. My patients with the on-off sedation strategy can't really project and communicate well in that way. My awake patients are, again, getting back to the lack of social isolation. Walking down the hall is so important, not just standing up next to the bed and trying to march in place, which was the highest level of activity achieved in the team trial. Walking down the hall is so important. You know, they walk down the hall, they see the nurse they had last week, they smile and wave, the nurse interacts with them. How you doing? You look great. It's great to see you out of your room. They look out our window. We have the fantastic view of San Francisco Bay. We talk about what landmarks they can see. We look at the trees and the park and the people and the, you know, you realize the normal world is out there waiting for you. So awake and walking needs to be the new standard of what we call early mobility. And I think what I hear you expressing by some of your recent experiences, from what we've heard about the team trial, from what we know COVID did to us, that the definition is actually getting smaller and smaller and tighter into this world of, well, let's just do a couple things in the bed. Let's turn the sedation on and off because we know that there's evidence saying that's a good thing to do. But I think we're really missing the big picture here. The patients need to be able to be awake, communicating, participating in their own care. I once had a conversation with Bill Schweikert, who's our hero of early mobility, from his Lancet 2009 randomized control trial that demonstrated starting mobility on day one instead of day seven really gave you less delirium, better functional mobility, more likely to discharge home, right? That was a big study that put us all in the excited position of wanting early mobility to be part of the bundle. I once had a conversation with him where he said, my dream is that all of our patients are either up in a chair, our ventilated patients, or they are tilted up to standing in a standing bed or in a combolizer, and they are awake and participating in their own rounds. So he wants his ET tube ventilated patients participating in rounds. Maybe that has to be the new standard, because obviously you need to be awake enough to understand what they're talking about and to write in your opinion about what they're saying about you and your care. So again, empowering E for empowering the patient to participate in their own care.
I love that. Absolutely. I think this will be really unique. A unique perspective for many that listen to this podcast or to this episode specifically. I am already thinking of people that I want to send this out to, because again, the definition is on the fritz.
There are, well, a lot of concerns. And if I had not seen it myself, I mean, I saw it in Polly Bailey's ICU, the Wake and Walking ICU. I seen it in our own ICU with our patients who are on ventilators for weeks, waiting for a lung transplant. They initially have a hard time walking. Couple days later, they realize walking is part of the routine. They communicate fully, but that's because they've had no sedation running night or day. They've just learned to make that adaption for their own benefit. So I've had patients where I've seen it do such magic, and I have also patients who have this switch flip, sedation on, sedation off, sedation on, sedation off. And yes, their eyes are open. Yes, they're RAS zero in the sedation off phase of the day, but mobilizing them is so challenging. They're CAM negative, but they still lack a lot of things that normal mobility should be able to provide to them. And we are denying them those benefits.
And from a nursing perspective, for so many patients, it's difficult to get them from sedated to a RAS of zero. I can't imagine wanting to do that every day. It's just right. challenging. So right. this is, and then it takes a lot more of your time and your effort with lower reward.
Yeah.
To have to then try to work through that sedation and that that cloud every day, yeah. every time with patients. So this is really also about making our process more efficient and more effective for our teams as well as our patients.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. You know, yep. The first day or two, it could be a bit of a wild ride to help this person get through their sedation wean. If they've come in from an outside hospital, they've been on sedation a long time. Are they going to get tachycardic? Yep. Are they going to get tachypneic? Yep. Are you going to have to, you know, help talk them down from that, help find other ways to ride that wave? Yeah, because otherwise you're going to be doing this every single day. And it's painful. It's a painful whack-a-mole process to have the sedation go on and off and on and off. And yeah.
And in the wake of walking, I see when we got patients from outside facilities and we were having to work through that process, everyone was bugged. We're willing to do it because it's the best thing for the patient, right? But also we wish that we could turn back the clock and have gotten them on day one.
Yes.
Because we knew that it would not be that difficult. That this whole scenario could have been prevented likely had we done our full wake and walking approach, never started sedation. They would not be that delirious. They would not maybe have ever developed delirium. They wouldn't be so weak. It wouldn't be so difficult to monitor that patient to then try to rehabilitate them. Everything got harder because of the perceived convenient route of sedation and mobility. It did not make it easier. And so everyone was really upset also just to see the patients suffer and be as scared and confused and debilitated as they were. That's really hard to swallow when you've seen the alternative. And so that's hopefully the perspective that our patients, our community will have in the future, is to say, here's the outcome that I want for my patient. I've seen it possible. I've seen it happen. And this is why we're doing this. And we're going to do it all the way. Heidi, thank you so much for everything that you've shared. We're going to keep tapping into your reservoir of knowledge. Heidi comes with me on site to train teams. So we're working collaboratively and we're excited to bring this to more ICUs. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kaylee. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Please keep doing all the great things you're doing. And thank you so much for having me today.
Thank you. Schedule a consultation for your ICU, as well as find supportive resources such as the free ebook, case studies, episode citations, and transcripts, please check out the website www.daytonicuconsulting.com.